From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, we're rebroadcasting some of our favorite conversations from earlier this year. Cookie Johnson reflects on her marriage to basketball legend Irvin Magic Johnson in her memoir, Believing in Magic. And actress Jamie Lee Curtis tackles immigration in her children's book, This Is Me, a story of who we are and where we came from. But first, with more than 20 million refugees around the world, a comprehensive international strategy to ending this crisis is critical. In September, the UN General Assembly met for the first ever Summit for Refugees and Migrants. President Obama also held his own Leaders Summit on Refugees. Margaret Wong, the Executive Director of Amnesty International, joins us to talk about the crisis and the global response. Margaret, good to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Maybe it's just me, but I don't want to say too little too late, but both of these summits seem a little late in coming. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're absolutely right. It took quite a long time for the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to organize his event. The negotiations were going on for several months, and ultimately they failed to accomplish anything meaningful.
So why so late on the part of the UN, and why so late? I've read pieces more than once from world leaders asking and calling on the Obama administration to hold a summit. So why so late on both of these persons holding these summits?
I think ultimately it's lack of political will. What we're seeing around the world is more and more governments who are shirking the responsibility that they should be taking for helping refugees. You mentioned more than 20 million refugees. There are actually more than 65 million displaced persons. So people who might not have crossed a border or who might not have been registered with the UN Agency for Refugees, but more than 65 million people who had to leave their homes because of war, because of civil conflict. And the world is shirking responsibility for helping these people find safety.
I was looking at these numbers the other day, and you know these numbers better than I do, if my recollection is right, where the Syrian refugees specifically are concerned. Canada took about 35,000. Yeah. Some countries have taken 500,000.
Yeah.
The U.S., 10,000. Unpack those numbers for me.
Well, interestingly, the United States' record on accepting refugees is actually one of the best ones in the world. This, in the last year, President Obama's administration has welcomed 85,000 refugees to this country, only 10,000 of which were from Syria. But we have refugees from all parts of the world. In fact, 86% of the world's refugees actually live in developing countries or are being hosted by developing countries. So the fact that we've taken such a tiny number means that we're actually not addressing the vast majority of the crisis.
What makes then, I hear your point about the fact that we are generally pretty good on these issues. What, and I'm not naive in asking this, but why is this Syrian refugee crisis then so tricky?
Well, that's a great question, Tavis. The reality is, in the last year, more than 50 pieces of legislation have been introduced in Congress trying to limit the number of refugees brought into the country, and particularly if they come from Muslim countries. So there's a narrative that has been created that is not unique to the United States, and we're definitely seeing it in other parts of the world, but that only certain refugees are good refugees, are refugees that we would be considering welcoming to our own country. And the rest have to stay in the countries that they've first landed in after leaving their homes.
So what happens then to these Syrian refugees in particular if, because of the tricky politics, they can't find safe spaces?
They end up having to stay in the neighboring countries that they've just reached, having fled Syria. So what that means is that Lebanon, for example, now hosts over 1 million refugees, and the population of Lebanon before this crisis was only 3 million, which means 1 in 4 people in the country is a refugee. Lebanon is now saying, we can't take any more refugees in, and I can understand how they must feel. And yet, countries of Europe, the United States, Australia, and others are all saying, well, we don't want that many refugees either. Maybe we'll take 10,000 or 30,000. But the rest of the millions of Syrians who fled their country have to stay in the host countries.
I was just in Europe not too long ago, over the summer, late in the summer, and it's clear to me, obviously, and to you, I suspect, that there are a number of governments that have become, shall we say, more right-wing, that those politics seem to be sweeping through Europe. How do those, you know, right-leaning politics impact and affect the refugee crisis?
Actually, it's one of our biggest concerns. Yeah. So at the UN summit, we heard a number of speeches by leaders from the European Union extolling the benefits of their own plans for refugees, which don't actually include welcoming people who are coming across their borders. Mm-hmm. The Prime Minister of Hungary, Orbán, actually said that we have built walls on our southern border to prevent false refugees from coming in and will only accept people whom we vetted and have designated as safe refugees. The new UK Prime Minister has also made an announcement that the UK will not be resettling any further refugees who cross into the border of Great Britain. Mm-hmm. Rather, they'll select and handpick the ones they think are safe to bring, and that it will be very small numbers like we've seen in the UK for the last few years. Mm. So this rhetoric of good refugees, bad refugees, whom we're willing to take, and just the overall sense of danger that refugees pose is actually increasing across the continent.
Tell me more about this distinction between good refugees and bad refugees.
Yeah, so the concept is if you leave your country, say Syria, and you land in Lebanon or Turkey, and you stay there, and you wait for several years until the UN Refugee Agency places you somewhere else with your family, you're a good refugee because you followed the correct path. But if you are in Turkey for a few years, your child has no access to education, you can't get a job, and you decide that you're going to take off for some other part of Europe in the hopes of getting those things for you and your family, then you're a bad refugee because you're no longer waiting to be resettled. You're actually becoming an economic migrant. That's the phrase that's being used by the UK, by Hungary, by others, by Poland. They want to see refugees stay in their original host countries and wait to be accepted by other countries.
So what then, if anything, came out of this UN summit on refugees and what came out of President Obama's leaders' summit on refugees? Anything?
Well, it was pretty disappointing. Yeah. We actually, Amnesty International declared the UN summit a failure before it started. So to be fair, that was our position before it even began.
And why?
And that's because the negotiations that they had been doing for the last several months failed to produce anything meaningful. I'll give you one example. One of the pieces of that agreement that they were working on would have made all countries agree to not detain children who are moving in refugee flows, but to allow children to be taken care of in normal ways. And instead, they dropped that provision from the final declaration that was issued, particularly at the urging of the U.S. government, which detains many, many immigrant children right now in detention centers across the country.
That explains why, though. The U.S. couldn't leave that language in at an international conference if we're doing that stateside.
And I'll share with you the latest ICE detainee numbers, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency here in the U.S., which is responsible for finding and then deporting people who shouldn't be here. They've actually now switched their strategy. Starting this past summer, as of May, they're now detaining more women, children, and families who've crossed the border into the U.S. in the last 2 years from Central America. Then they're deporting the so-called criminal folks who've committed some sort of crime, and that's why they're being detained and deported. There are now fewer of those people than the families and the unaccompanied children who've been coming from Central America.
All right, so the UN failure, the UN summit on refugees was a failure before it ever started,
says
Amnesty International. What about Obama's leaders' summit?
Well, Obama's summit we were a little more hopeful about, and that's because he actually required that countries make new commitments to resettlement and resources for refugees in order to receive an invitation. Unfortunately, by the end, when he actually convened the summit, many of the governments who came did not make new commitments. There were a few, but certainly not the numbers we'd hoped to see. And countries like Germany, who was a co-host of the convening, did not make any new commitments to resettlement.
So does that mean he put out this, he drew a line, and then, I mean, what happened?
And then it got
then
a little fuzzy there.
Kind of moved a little bit.
And I think they were trying to demonstrate that there was larger interest in moving these numbers forward. Unfortunately, the numbers didn't bear that up. And so I think we've really missed an important opportunity to try to fix these problems moving forward.
So what are the solutions to this worldwide refugee crisis?
We've got to do a few things. One is we have to really challenge the narrative of refugees as dangerous. One of the most important things is to counter the narrative of particular refugees being dangerous. And so the sort of anti-Muslim, anti-Islamophobic rhetoric that we've been hearing in this country is certainly being echoed in other countries. Mm-hmm. And so we have to work collectively to change that. Amnesty International actually has launched a campaign here in the U.S. called The America I Believe In. Mm-hmm. And we're asking people to really challenge that narrative in their local papers, mm-hmm. with their members of Congress, and to really push back on the sense that these are people we need to be fearful of. Mm-hmm. You know well, Tavis, the people who go through the refugee process to get here spend 2 years mm-hmm. getting vetted. They're checked more than anybody else who comes to the United States. So, you know, it's important that people learn the facts about refugees and actually start to welcome them.
Speaking of U.S., it's important I ask this, I think. I haven't had a chance to read it as yet, I confess, but I just had on my desk this report you all just put out about police brutality in this country. I mean, I haven't read it yet, but just tell me more what I'm going to find when I dig into this report you all just put out about what's happening in this country.
2 years ago in Ferguson, we sent a group of Amnesty staff and members to be human rights observers as to what was happening on the ground. And we started doing some research on the Missouri state law. When are police in Missouri allowed to use lethal force in response to something happening? Mm-hmm. And we were shocked to find out that in Missouri law, the police could actually use lethal force to stop someone who was running away from a police officer. Not someone who was threatening them or who'd committed a crime or anything, but just someone running away. Mm-hmm. And so we realized there really wasn't a good chance of prosecuting Officer Wilson because he was in compliance with state law. And then we thought that had to be the worst law in the United States, right? Yeah. So we did a study. And the Deadly Force Report, which is on our website, actually looks at every single state's laws on when police can use lethal force. And we're looking at it in comparison to standards that have been set by the United Nations. The UN has a set of basic principles on use of force and firearms mm-hmm. that our government and many other governments contributed to. And yet, not a single United States or the District of Columbia are in compliance with these UN principles. And in fact, 13 states aren't even in compliance with the lower standards that are set by US constitutional law.
How do you explain that?
I think it's a place where people have long ignored what the standards should be and really how we should be training our police officers. The UN principles are not unusual. They say things like you have to give a warning before you use lethal force.
Right.
You have to make sure there are no innocent bystanders who could be harmed by using lethal force. And most importantly, it has to be an effort of last resort. You know, mm-hmm. you can only use lethal force because your life or the life of someone else is threatened or serious injury is threatened. And yet in the U.S., police can use lethal force all the time. There are 9 states that allow police to use lethal force to suppress a riot. And because often protests in this country have been deemed riots mm-hmm. by local police, that raises serious concerns for us that by calling a protest a riot, police would then be allowed to use lethal force to disperse people from the scene.
I thought I just read a piece, though, where there was a judge in Massachusetts who just ruled that that a cop does not have the right to shoot a suspect who's fleeing because one can reasonably assume in this environment a suspect or the person fleeing might be able to reasonably assume that his life is threatened when he comes in contact with the cop, given all the shootings that we've been seeing.
I suspect that this may indicate some more consideration by the courts. The mm-hmm. Supreme Court ruled in Tennessee versus Warner that the police could not shoot someone who was not posing a threat. Unless, and they carved out some caveats. So, for example, if the person was running away from custody mm-hmm. and there was no way to stop them, they could use lethal force. So the U.S. constitutional standards are a step in the right direction, but they don't go as far as the U.N. principles demand. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, as I said, we have 9 states that don't have any law at all about the lethal use of force by police. 13 states that don't meet the constitutional standards. We have a long way to go to try to protect citizens.
Yeah. What say you, Margaret, about this notion that exists in our country, particularly amongst my conservative Republican friends, where they have no regard for the UN, they have no regard for international courts, this notion that the U.S. is a sovereign nation and we are not subject to the rules of a governing body like the UN, The Hague, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure. Well, the United Nations has no authority over the United States. Mm-hmm. It's not an oversight body. It's a convening of countries around the world. Mm-hmm. And its purpose is to have countries agree to certain things. The U.S. participated in the crafting of those principles mm-hmm. on the use of lethal force. So our police forces participated in that process and weighed in because we have a lot that we can share about mm-hmm. what works and what doesn't work in policing. Unfortunately, because our law enforcement system is so complicated here, there are many, many police agencies who don't know about the UN principles or even the constitutional requirements. Mm-hmm. The US has more than 16,000 police departments. So really trying to get all of them to understand mm-hmm. even the constitutional standards is really a challenge. And I know it's something that the Department of Justice has been struggling with.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious as to how Amnesty, as an organization, as an entity, decides what it's going to track. Because when there is so much, mm-hmm. how might I put this, when there's so great a contestation of the humanity of people in this country and around the globe, as an organization, how do you decide what you're going to focus on?
It is the hardest question that we face.
Yeah.
I have to say, we actually go through a pretty large consultation with our members here in the mm-hmm. United States. And the amnesty movement around the world consults with members across all of our 70 countries where mm-hmm. we have a presence. And we asked them all to weigh in. And it was pretty clear to everyone that refugees were an issue that had to be addressed mm-hmm. for the next few years because the crisis is across the globe. There's no part of the world that isn't touched by it. Mm-hmm. Other areas of work, like police accountability and gun violence, mm-hmm. are things that we in the U.S. decided that we really wanted to lift up as a priority campaign. But we still have a lot of work going on to fight the death penalty, to promote women's rights and stop violence against women, and of course to counter security that violates our human rights, national security policies. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of work that we do. It is hard to pick and choose. But it's all very compelling.
It is indeed compelling. My read is, you tell me if I'm right or wrong, or if you agree or disagree, but my read is that on the death penalty, we're mm-hmm. starting to make some progress.
Yes, we are.
With states rethinking. Am I right about this?
Yes, we are.
Yeah, yeah.
We're not out of the woods yet, but 19 states have formally abolished the death penalty, and there are another dozen that haven't actually practiced the death penalty in more than a decade, so clearly they're not mm-hmm. contemplating using it. We are at a crossroads, and I'm hopeful that in the next few years we could see some real progress on banning that.
What might aid and abet pushing us across the line on that?
We need more people to speak out about the importance of not using the death penalty. Some of the most compelling voices have been from families of victims mm-hmm. who've come forward and said, that's not the way I seek justice for my loved one. And I think we need to have more people speaking out with our members of Congress and urging them to abolish this practice.
You mentioned national security a moment ago. What's Amnesty particularly hearing in this campaign season in this country on the issue of national security that's most concerning to you?
Some of our biggest concerns have come from a resurgence of practices that are, in fact, deep violations of human mm-hmm. rights, like the use of torture, mm-hmm. Like arbitrary detention of people without trial, mm-hmm. and the more than 60 detainees who are still in Guantanamo today are having ever-shrinking opportunities for getting out or for getting a trial. And I think the fact that we haven't heard candidates speaking out more mm-hmm. in favor of security with human rights, policies that actually protect human rights, we have a lot of concerns about some of the rhetoric.
Some folk find that phrase itself oxymoronic, security mm-hmm. with human rights. Can you do both simultaneously?
I think you have to. In fact, I think if you violate human rights in the name of national security, you end up causing further political problems for yourself, and you end up spurring further resentment and antagonism. A perfect example of that is our work on the use of drones to assassinate people around the world. Mm-hmm. The U.S. has been using this as a tool in our war against terrorism for the last several years. And yet so many times we've documented that the use of those drones has actually targeted civilians, mm-hmm. people who had nothing to do with terrorism or even with criminal activity. And yet the U.S. has done nothing to acknowledge those killings, mm-hmm. to make reparations to the families who've suffered losses, or even to really take a look at whether this program is the right way to go about fighting terrorism.
I've said many times on this program and beyond, and I think it's always hard for certain people to swallow, but Barack Obama has killed more innocent women and children with drones than George Bush did. And that's just hard for me to even fathom, having, you know, supported this guy when he ran twice, that he's killed more innocent women and children than Bush did with this drone program. And to your point, we won't even talk about it.
That's right.
It's the most secretive thing in Washington. Speaking of President Obama, though, you mentioned Guantanamo. It feels to me, I hope I'm wrong about this, but it feels to me that he may end up leaving office in just a few months, not having honored the campaign promise that he made 8 years ago to close Guantanamo. How is Amnesty reading the back and forth? Because depending on whose column you read, you can have a different take on what the president has done, has not done, should have done to get Guantanamo closed. How's Amnesty reading it?
Well, I'll tell you, the president has had his hands tied quite significantly by Congress, and we acknowledge that. But we are still pushing hard, and we are asking him to make this commitment real before he leaves office. Those 61 people could receive trials. Those 61 people could be resettled elsewhere. Those 61 people could be moved to a different detention center. But ultimately, the United States should not be holding people without trial. That's a fundamental violation of human rights. And the president knows it, and I know his administration is working hard, but they have to meet that deadline.
Let me ask you a question that might be a bit impolitic, but I want to ask you anyway. And that is, with all the great work that Amnesty International does and other human rights organizations, I wonder whether or not you think that you're fighting an uphill battle, which is to say that we are living in a time, living in an era, and frankly, living in a country where we talk a good game about the value and the sanctity and the dignity of human life, but don't really mean that. And Exhibit A would be the killings of these black men so often by cops and black women. So it just seems to me that if we really do value the dignity and humanity of all life, then all of us are somehow complicit in the cops killing these people if we don't use our voices to say something about it. That's a long way of asking whether or not we even care about human rights the way we suggest or intimate that we do.
Well, I have to be more optimistic because that's my job. But I'll share with you, I have been seeing some interesting data on how millennials see human rights, particularly millennials in the U.S. And I'm actually very heartened. Millennials believe that human rights should be a much stronger factor in making our foreign policy and domestic policy. And millennials don't see a distinction between human rights for people overseas and human rights here. They understand it's connected. When we talk about police accountability here in the United States, we also talk about it in Brazil, where the number of young black men being killed by police and civilian militias has grown astronomically over the last few years, particularly in anticipation of the Olympics. We talk about police torture in Mexico. We talk about police torture in Nigeria. It's connected. And the people who are struggling and fighting to stop these violations have to be united and have to be linked up in fighting back. And that's really what Amnesty's purpose is. We have more than 8 million members and supporters around the world who are trying to build a grassroots movement to show that we're not willing to settle for this and that status quo is not acceptable. And we're going to push for human rights around the world.
Conversation we don't have often enough in this country. A deep dive into what it is that we truly believe as a nation about the value of life, all life. Margaret Wong is from Amnesty International. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. 25 years ago, basketball icon Irvin Magic Johnson announced that he was HIV positive. His announcement stunned his fans and rocked his marriage to our next guest, Cookie Johnson. Mrs. Johnson shares her side of the story and opens up about her journey in her new memoir. It's called Believing in Magic. Cookie, good to have you on the program.
It's clear to me in reading the text that there is for you, which didn't surprise me, I guess, I haven't known you guys for so long, but there is Irvin and there is Magic. Who is Irvin and who is Magic?
Irvin is this guy that I met, you know, back at Michigan State. He was a nice guy, big eyes, lots of promise in his eyes, big smile, you know, always happy and always fun-loving, looking for, you know, the fun in life. Magic is more intense. Magic is more about, you know, like he used to call it having the game face when he went on, you know, when he was playing, and you know, just more serious and more intense, and you know, more about, you know, the fame and the glory, I guess.
In 25 years of marriage, have you had trouble ever juxtaposing the two?
Yeah, I hated magic.
Yeah, okay.
All right, now it's getting good.
I didn't like him. Okay. I didn't like him very much.
You loved Irvin, but Magic, not so much.
Magic I didn't like so much.
And why not? Tell me why.
I don't know. He Magic was all about magic, you know, and not looking at other people and considering other people's feelings. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't like him very much because that's not who I met. He's not the guy that I met back at, you know, Michigan State when we first. And then, like, as we went on, it's really interesting because whenever he would come home and visit me, you know, he would be Irvin again. Mm-hmm. You know, but sometimes then like, when I would come out to L.A. to visit him, it was a little different.
You were visiting Magic.
Yeah, it was a little different. Or when I wasn't here, I would see Magic on TV, you know.
Since you mentioned that, how much difficulty does a girl from Michigan have, not just moving to L.A., but moving to L.A. already in the shadow of this iconic figure in the city? How did you make the adjustment?
Well, first of all, you know, I didn't do it right away.
Yeah.
And that's what I talk about in the book. Mm-hmm. You know, the book is a 25-year span. Mm-hmm. So it talks about when we first met and our courtship. And our relationship was long distance for at least 10 years, mm-hmm. off and on. And there were 2 4-year breakups in there. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it that way, it was important for me to hold on to who I was. So I stayed in school. I got my degree. I wanted to be a buyer. My degree was in retailing of clothing and textiles. So when I graduated, I moved to Toledo, Ohio, working for the mercantile company. And I was just pursuing my career. We were dating, but for me, it was important to stay true to who I was. Mm-hmm. And I knew I couldn't do that moving to LA and following him. So I purposely did not do that for a long time. Yeah. And then after we broke up from our engagement, and then we slowly got back together after 4 years, that's when we both said, listen, if we're gonna try to make this thing work, we gotta figure out if we could even live in the same city first, you know, before even living in the same home.
Right.
And so that's when I decided to kind of give up my career there and move. And it was a very scary thing.
Yeah. When you have, by your own admission, 2 different 4-year breakups in a relationship, when something doesn't work twice, it's not 4 months, it's 2 separate 4-year breakups.
Right.
How do you find reason to believe still in whatever this thing is?
Yeah, it's scary and it's hard.
Yeah.
I think that's why it took so long for us to get back together because, you know, after the breakups, I couldn't go right back to what we were doing. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have worked. And I knew it. Even though my heart said, I love you and I want to be with you, but we both knew that it wasn't gonna work. So what we did was we just started learning how to be friends. So it took that 4 years to develop this friendship we had. And that kind of like brought the love back. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We always had the love there, but maybe that brought the trust back.
Yeah.
That's what it did.
The subtitle of this text is My Story of Love, which I get, overcoming adversity, which I get, and keeping the faith. Unpack that part for me, keeping the faith.
Well, you know, for me, I've always been a woman of faith. And even I talk a little bit in the book about when I was a child and how my parents didn't go to church every Sunday like, you know, most people who are religious. Mm-hmm. But the lady across the street did. And I was probably like 5 years old. And she asked my mom, could she take me to church with her? Mm-hmm. And I was like, and my mom would dress me up and send me across the street and I go to church. You know, and so I was always in the presence of God. Mm-hmm. And even just being in church and not knowing what's going on as a kid, but you know you're in the presence of God. So I've always felt like through my life, God was always pulling me closer and closer to him. And so sometimes you go through trials and trials teach you something, you know, and you've got to learn what it teaches you. And what it taught me was to dig deeper into the Lord, to dig deeper into the Word. And for instance, the biggest one came after our first broken engagement, and I was just devastated. You know, I didn't know how to get off my couch. You know, I didn't know how to face the world because this was not only something we went through privately, but it was public, you know, with the world. And so my friend said, just, you know, open that Bible and start reading it. And, you know, God is always there with you, and He will give you strength to make it through this. And, you know, even though I was going to church, I wasn't reading, Tavis. I wasn't reading and understanding the Word. So what I found is I had to learn how to trust God. And, you know, in His Word, understand His Word. Like, He has promises in there that he you know, that He will never leave you, that He will take care of your problems. Like, you know, if somebody's attacking you, no weapons formed against me shall prosper. Or, I will never leave you. I'm with you always, you know. So I learned all these things. And what I know is when you learn them, you know how to use them and call on them, it unleashes His power.
And yet with all of that, because I have the same experience and others do watching this program, yet with all of that, there are times in any relationship where you feel that you have been betrayed.
Yes.
Where you feel like God is not hearing your prayer.
Yes.
Where you feel like there's more on you than you can bear.
Right.
In this relationship, how did you navigate through those moments?
Because I went back to God, and then I said, and what God told me is, listen, you need to let go of all that. Give it to me. Let me handle it. And then you need to seek me more. You need to, you know, learn to have a relationship with me.
Yeah.
That should be your goal.
Yeah.
Develop that close relationship with me, and when you do that with that, the other thing will come.
How have you, over these 25 years, kept your own counsel? Put another way, how have you learned how to talk to yourself and not listen to yourself?
Right.
Versus listening to other people.
You know, it's hard to do, but I learned it over the years. I didn't do it right away, but I learned it over the years of dealing with him. And what Irvin and I both found out that works best for us was to shed everybody else out. And that's how, you know, when we were doing that, getting that friendship together, that's what we had to do. And you just, like, I stopped reading all the papers. I stopped looking at all the, you know, you know, rag magazines and everything. And, you know, just dealt with the two of us and shed everybody else out. You know, there's a few people, like, you know, your family members. They were always supportive of us, both mine and his. And keeping people like that close to you. And, you know, they always teach you, they teach you, too, that, you know, you shouldn't keep negative people around you regardless. You know, and so you got to keep people around you who are positive and who really care about you.
There's a fine line, I think, Cookie, between deep abiding love, it's a real thin line, between deep abiding love and willful blindness. In other words, sometimes we're in situations where, you know, you might love the person, but it's really just a bad situation.
Yes.
And people use love oftentimes as a reason or as an excuse to stay in something that they really should get out of.
Yeah.
If you deserve credit for anything, it's that you are so, I was like shocked about how transparent you are in this book. And clearly, you guys have the last word because it's lasted for 25 years.
Right.
But how did you know in those moments that it was love and not you just saying, you just being stupid?
You know, you didn't really know. You didn't really know. I just like went with my gut, you know, most of the time. And again, I kept trusting God. Like, God, you know, is this the right thing for me? You know. And every time I felt it wasn't, that's when we broke up. And you know what's the most important thing to me, what I found through our relationship is you have to have respect for one another. And when you don't feel that you're being respected, either one of you, then you need to have a conversation. So the next thing you have to have, be able to communicate. And a lot of people can't do that. Because when you have a problem and you want to talk to somebody, either one person will shut down or, you know, a big fight will come up. You're accusing me of what? And then, so you got to learn how to talk to each other. And you got to learn how to talk to each other without things blowing up. And the most important thing is to clear it up before it turns into something big. You know that whole saying, you know, try to, you know, don't go to bed mad. That's for real. You know, because if you do, the next morning you wake up and you thought about all this and it's been festering all night. You know, and you wake up and you're ready to go. So it's important to learn how to communicate. And it took us 10, 12 years to learn how to do that. And more than that.
There are a few people in the world, a few people that I've had more fun hanging out with over the years than Magic. He's just a fun, great guy to hang out with. And I feel so blessed and fortunate, you know, that my life, you know, paralleled his. We got to be friends along with you. But what's the best thing about being with Magic all these years?
You know, we've developed a love that's, you know, unconditional over years. And maybe because we've been through so much.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, we along the way, we both have developed a love for God. And I, of course, before him, but now he's come along to this place where he loves God as much as I do. And we both know without God in our life that this marriage would not be, you know, anywhere. And then to know where the future is going to be, you know. So this 25-year, you know, I talk about this. I wrote this book because I look back over the 25 years, right? And I say, wow, look how far we've come. Mm-hmm. You know, 25 years ago in 1991, when Irvin made the announcement, everybody said he was in denial. You know, because you're a part of that media. Everybody said, he's not going to be around here, a long time. Why does he say that? He's in denial. And I wanted to write this book to say, look, it's 25 years later, and he's alive. He's well. He's thriving. Not only is he well, he's thriving.
He's
doing amazing things, you know. And this is how we did it.
The book is called Believing in Magic, My Story of Love, Overcoming Adversity, and Keeping the Faith, written by the New York Times bestselling author. Cookie Johnson.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. My next guest, Jamie Lee Curtis, became a household name after starring in the 1978 horror classic Halloween. She's appeared in so many iconic movies since then, Trading Places and A Fish Called Wanda, just to name a couple. She recently returned to her horror roots in the Fox TV series Scream Queens, which is now in its second season. She's also an author of several best-selling children's books. Her latest is called This Is Me, the story of who we are and where we came from. Jamie Lee joins us now.
I was asking you just a moment ago how you and Laura Cornell met, because you guys...
We make good books.
You guys make good books.
We make good books.
You really do.
I know. We barely know each other, too.
Yeah.
She's extraordinary. When my girl was born, Annie, I was given a book called Annie Banani by a wonderful writer named Leah Kamiko. And it was illustrated by Laura Cornell. And you know what it is? I was raised with these things called little golden books, which were these sort of cherubic white people books. Mm-hmm. They were all the little kids had blonde hair and perfect little outfits. And that's just not the way I look at the world. I didn't feel that way as a child. I felt like my pigtails were never even. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember tugging on them, trying to get them even, could never get them even. And the way she illustrates is, I think, the way the world is, which is askew.
Yeah.
Nothing matches. Everybody's a little off.
Yeah.
And I love what she does.
Yeah. When I got into this, I was just, it's great work as always.
Thank you.
But I was tickled and taken by the fact that in a moment like this, you all can take an issue like this.
Yeah, far out.
And make it relatable for kids.
And yet it wasn't, you know, I wrote this 3 years ago. It was way before the Syrian refugee crisis began.
Right.
It was way before we started seeing the people trying to, in Greece, that mountain of life vests that have become, the image of that has become so synonymous with Exodus.
Right.
This was not a book about Exodus. This was a book about America. You know, this was really a book. It was both something that I had known, a teacher who taught a lesson like this, as well as the Michael Moore documentary, Where to Invade Next, where the German government teaches, as part of their school curriculum, teaches German students the Holocaust, using a suitcase as a metaphor for having to leave.
Right.
So for me, it was the promise of America. It was not the world refugees crisis. It was really how America was built, because here we are in a country, politically now, we're being told that we're gonna build walls and keep people out. And yet this is a country built by immigrants, filled with immigrants. There's not, except for Native Americans, we are a country of immigrants. And so it's an interesting political moment versus a humanitarian moment.
There are two or three questions in that. Let me take them one at a time, as if I could do it any other way.
Sorry.
Yes, Quay. So the first question is, I wonder if this is a message that will resonate, I think so, but you tell me, a message that will resonate with kids, because it seems to be a lesson that adults are either ignoring or conveniently forgetting that we are a nation of immigrants?
I think it's a big lesson we're omitting.
Yeah.
And as we generationally stay here, we are distant farther and farther concentric circle from our roots, from our original heritage.
Right.
So there's no more dialects on the radio. You go anywhere in the country, it's the exact same voice. Hi, it's, you know, FM radio.
Yeah.
And nobody sounds like where they're from. So people have lost their language, they've lost their culture, they've lost their connection to really the beginnings of who we are, which is our heredity, our family histories. And so it was a book as an object lesson to both talk about who we are today materially.
Right.
Like, what are you into? What am I into? What is a child? What's important to them? But then, of course, as the back of the book, it actually says, and I won't read, obviously, the whole book, but it says, for who you all are isn't just what you've got, but part what you learn and part what you're taught. Who you become starts with your past, family histories, and stories that last. This great tide that brought you, seeds ancestors sowed that took root inside you and helped you to grow.
Mm.
Then at the end of the book,
I love this,
which is a story of what would you put in a suitcase, is a suitcase.
There
so as
go.
A family member, grandparent, teacher, brother, sister, significant friend, you can sit with a reader and really just start to, excuse the term, unpack the idea, which is, who are you? What's important to you? And I can tell you, each of us would have different things. My son would have something different. And it starts to inform us. And this whole idea of an identity, that this is who I am, is really important.
Yeah.
And so both that we are our pasts, but we are also our futures.
I find that one of the reasons why that identity is lost is because when people come here, they feel this need, this desire, for whatever reason, not just to fit in, but to assimilate. And that's a choice that people make. Assimilation, I think, oftentimes is a choice that people make, and I don't think that's a good choice.
Well, they assimilate because they want to be accepted.
Yeah.
You know, they are, if you come to a country that won't allow you to wear a veil because they are afraid of you, you are forced into assimilation. That is a forced assimilation that takes away your option of whether you do or don't.
Right.
And I think it is each generation's choice as to what do they hang on to from their cultural heritage and what do they want to create in their new heritage. And that, by the way, that divide and that conflict in a family is forever.
Yeah.
How many parents, me, have gone, ugh, when I was my daughter's age, I did this because I worked really hard. It's just irrelevant because we're not here now.
Yeah.
We're not in the zeitgeist of today. We're old people. And they're making their way, the millennials. Guess what? I work with 8, 9 millennials on my TV show. It's easy for me to say that when I was young, I worked really hard. These people work hard too.
How does that make you feel? How do you process? What's the takeaway for you being around those millennials every day?
Well, it's a very positive takeaway because it's made me realize that this pejorative X-gen slacker is just not the case. What I think is the most damning for this generation is that the opportunities haven't been there for them the way they were for me and you. And so what happens is they've had to kind of go at it in a different way. And it's very exciting to watch them work social media, work technology, work it to then create a brand which then allows them to deliver their work, their message to this new world.
Back to this book. How would, if there is a difference, tell me, how would an American-born child read this book, This Is Me, different from a newly arrived immigrant or refugee to our country?
Well, my guess is that the first thing that would happen is the American child would have tremendous stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, we're a big nation of stuff. Socioeconomically, obviously, there are going to be differences, mm-hmm. but people still, there's a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. Whereas people coming from refugees are coming with nothing, mm-hmm. but hopefully the clothes on their back, their family papers, hopefully some food to eat on the journey. You know, people who took the journey. This book is not a refugee's book. Mm-hmm. This book is about the promise and excitement that coming to America offered people.
Offered ED or offer still?
I don't think we offer it the way we did because there's so many, I think there's so much stay away mm-hmm. with our hand up.
You and Laura have done just a miraculous job of writing these very successful books for children,
yeah.
writing and illustrating these books for children. What particular hope for this country do you think rest in these babies? Because my sense is that you wouldn't be writing books for them about issues like these if you didn't think that there was some hope for the Demos, some hope for this democracy that these children hold. What is that?
What I hope is that we become a society not drugged and blunted by the corporate world that seems to be directing us. I hope that there is a revolution, and it is not. It is a revolution against the corporation. I'm terrified about childhood obesity, mm-hmm. opiate addiction, depression. I'm worried that. What I hope is that these children find their minds and that they find their minds through the process of education, mm-hmm. food, environment, that allows them to have a mind, that then they will grow a mind of their own, that then will become the advocates for the future that we are trying to be now in our adulthood. That's what I hope. That's what I hope goes in their suitcases is a mind.
Yeah.
An open, free, roving, interesting, contradictory mind that is theirs and not one that is force-fed, GMO, politically correct mind. I hope it's a mind free to wander wherever it wants to go.
Yeah. The new book from Jamie Lee Curtis, illustrated by Laura Cornwell, is called This Is Me. A story of who we are and where we came from. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nciabwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.